An oil refinery shut down after a fire this summer. Some neighbors are relieved.
I'm glad that happened. It needed to happen. And they ain't never got to open back up as far as I'm concerned, really.
I'm Carol Holzapfel. This week on the Allegheny Front, others wonder how to shutter a carbon-polluting industry in a way that's fair to workers. And a new book looks at getting more renewable energy online by changing the way we deliver electricity to customers.
We don't have a single electrical system in the United States. We have 50 different systems.
Plus, President Trump is tooting his own horn when it comes to his environmental record.
From day one, my administration has made it a top priority to ensure that America is among the very cleanest air and cleanest water on the planet.
But do the president's claims check out? We'll fact check them. Those and more environmental stories are coming up on the Allegheny Front. Stay with us. A draft agreement between U.S. Steel and Allegheny County health officials does not go far enough. That's according to the comments of environmental advocates and some residents at a public hearing on July 30th. The hearing was held to discuss a $2.7 million settlement drawn up by the two parties last month. The county could try to change the agreement based on public comment. For State Impact Pennsylvania, the Allegheny Front's Reed Frazier reports.
The agreement resolved penalties the Allegheny County Health Department issued to the company for violations at the Clairton Coke Works. In addition to a fine, the agreement called on the company to make a series of upgrades to its pollution controls at the plant, which the county has blamed for declining air quality in the Pittsburgh region. The company says those upgrades will cost it $200 million and will cut down on pollution. But many at the meeting said they'd heard those promises before. Gloria Ford said she'd had to go to a hospital earlier this month because she had trouble breathing the air in Clairton.
U.S. Steel acts with impunity. God forbid that the unhealthy air we breathe would be put upon them and their families.
Several workers at the plant spoke in favor of the agreement, saying it would allow them to keep their jobs while cleaning up Pittsburgh's air. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Reed Frazier.
Andy Ott, the CEO of the nation's largest power grid, announced his retirement last month. Now a coalition, including state and local officials, as well as environmental advocates, are calling on the grid operator to choose a new leader who will be more focused on clean energy. State Impact Pennsylvania's Marie Cusick has more.
PJM Interconnection is headquartered outside Philadelphia and manages the flow of wholesale electricity in all or part of 13 mid-Atlantic and Midwestern states, including Pennsylvania. Like an air traffic controller for the power system, it helps ensure the lights stay on, managing which plants send electricity onto the grid at any given moment. PJM also functions as a kind of stock exchange, overseeing the wholesale marketplace for electricity. Right now, about two-thirds of its power come from fossil fuels. Rob Altenberg of the environmental group Penn Future says as PJM searches for a new CEO, that person should be focused on addressing climate change.
PJM's rules are built, from an era that was focused on fossil fuels, and the rules will end up benefiting fossil fuels.
A PJM spokeswoman says its system is more diverse than it has ever been, but acknowledged that more could be done to attract renewable resources. Marie Cusick, State Impact Pennsylvania.
PJM is just one regional transmitter of electrical power. Across the country, there's a patchwork of grids providing reliable power to Americans. And they mostly rely on fossil fuels to keep a steady flow of electricity. A new book by Wall Street Journal energy reporter Russell Gold looks at one man's mission to get more renewable wind energy online and into American homes and businesses. He focuses this effort on transmission lines and a more thoughtful connection of these grids. The book is called Superpower, and I recently spoke with Gold about it. It's a nonfiction book, but your protagonist is Michael Skelly. And just say a little bit about his background and who he is.
Yeah, sure. He was a Peace Corps volunteer, went down to Costa Rica, came back and decided he wanted to go to Harvard Business School. But when he was coming out of Harvard Business School, felt that he wanted the most interesting job of any of his classmates. And he also wanted to make sure he never wore a tie. And the job he eventually found was to go back to Costa Rica and built, I believe it was the first tram that you could take to travel through the rainforest. He built that, and then he sort of looked around and said, well, what else do I want to do? I kind of enjoy the challenge of building a big project. And so he got into building renewable energy. And this is in the 1990s. Renewable energy really hadn't started to take off yet. But he ended up coming back to the United States and built some very small wind farms in Pennsylvania, actually not too far from Pittsburgh, and in Minnesota and California, many, many places.
Yeah, so Skelly got really good at setting up successful wind power stations across the country. He knows how to generate wind regionally, but the real question is how to get it to more customers, how to get more of it online. So the meat of your book is sort of when Skelly turns his attention to the idea of transmitting wind power across the country. And it doesn't go smoothly. What happens? What kind of obstacles does he face?
Right. Well, so Skelly, and everyone calls him Skelly. No, I've never met anyone who calls him Michael. Skelly was looking around, and he sort of came to the conclusion that the one thing holding back renewable energy was that it needed more transmission lines. And what I mean by that is there are parts in the middle of the country, in Oklahoma and the Texas Panhandle and Kansas, where you can generate, the wind is just phenomenal there, and you can generate lots of energy at a really low price. It's just there's not many people out there. There's not many factories. There's not much demand for the wind. Transmission lines are very big electrical lines. They can move power over long distances. And so he set out to build a privately funded transmission line that would go from the Oklahoma Panhandle all the way across Oklahoma, across Arkansas, and into Tennessee. And the reason he wanted to get into Tennessee is that the Tennessee Valley Authority has just a great transmission network there. They were planning to build somewhere about 24 nuclear power plants at one point, but they only ended up building 8 or 9. So they had lots of excess transmission. So if you could get it across the Mississippi into the Memphis area, then you can piggyback on existing transmission and, frankly, get the power anywhere you needed it. Atlanta, Philadelphia, Washington, up into Pittsburgh. And so that was his plan. And encountered lots of sort of difficulties along the way. Mostly that the way we've set up our power system, we've created these regional energy utilities, these little states within electricity. Someone once made the observation, which I think is absolutely true, that we don't have a single electrical system in the United States. We have 50 different systems. Every state is looking very much inward to develop its own grid and to make sure its people are served. Nobody was looking at the ways in which if you tie together multiple states, you can have benefits. And it was a real problem. And he encountered a lot of incumbent utilities and also politicians who, frankly, just didn't want to change the status quo.
And we should say the reason that Tennessee or states in the Southeast might want to buy wind energy from the plains and from the West is because it's not that easy to generate wind power in the Southeast. The wind is not reliable.
There is one wind farm in Tennessee, and it only blows about 20% of the time. Now, compare that to what goes on in the Great Plains. These wind turbines are not up on top of mountains. They're not blocking view sheds. And a good location will generate wind 50, 60% of the time. Just it's a huge difference.
So a theme in the book is there's a long history right up to the present of states or even local communities opposing the transmission of wind or other power across state lines, which really doesn't directly benefit them. You know, but advocates like Skelly argue that we all benefit from cleaner power as a nation. Has this tension been resolved in any way?
No, this tension's very much still there. I mean, this is one of the things when you write about energy, which I've done for a long time, that you keep coming across time and again. And it's sort of the what's in it for me perspective. One of the big holdups in this transmission line that Skelly proposed was that the people of Arkansas, where the line was crossing, were sort of saying, well, what do we get from this? And they were being offered jobs. They were being offered some of the power. But they just felt like, look, this is being imposed on us. We don't want to do this. And we've seen this before. We saw it up in Minnesota in the 1970s when there's this now forgotten what was called an energy war, where the farmers of Minnesota literally went to war and tried to stop a power line from being built across their land because they didn't feel like they were getting anything from it. The power grid in the United States has the potential to bring us all together, to deliver electricity from one part of the country to another when they need it, and sometimes at a price that's beneficial. But it's not going to work if everyone sort of looks at, you know, in their backyard and say, well, what's in this for me? I don't want this. You know, I wrote about it in this current book, Superpower. But I also wrote about it in my last book, The Boom, about fracking, where definitely people in Pennsylvania, around Pittsburgh and out in north central Pennsylvania, who were generating all this natural gas that was going to the cities and elsewhere, and other people were benefiting from them. And they were saying, well, you know, why do we have to be the ones who sacrifice to generate all this natural gas? You know, I found a similar resistance with renewable energy, which frankly really surprised me, because renewable energy transmission lines, they don't pollute. You know, once they're installed, you kind of tend to forget where they are.
You know, his plan ultimately failed. His company was sold off into pieces. But it doesn't seem like he feels like that's a failure.
Well, you know, Michael Skelly is a fascinating character. I focused on the book about one particular transmission line, really the most notable of the transmission lines. But his company, Clean Line Energy Partners, was working on three or four different lines. Two of those lines look like they actually might get built. He had to sell them off, but the people who bought them are actively pursuing it. The idea that he was trying to push, that if we build transmission, that will spur massive amount of renewable energy growth. That idea, I think, is still very much alive. And I look at something like offshore wind. For 20 years, some of the pioneers of offshore wind were trying to advance projects and just running into a buzzsaw of political pushback and lawsuits. We're going to ultimately have 20 nuclear power plants worth of offshore wind within the next 10 years. So sometimes it takes that pioneer to just sort of push the rock up the hill, and sometimes the rock slips and falls back and sort of crushes him. But other people are watching and learning, and I think that's very much the case. We're going to see more long-distance transmission built, and it's going to open up the middle of the country to just very large amounts of renewable energy generation.
Russell Gold's book is called Superpower, One Man's Quest to Transform American Energy. And there's more at our website, AlleghenyFront.org. You're listening to The Allegheny Front. I'm Kara Holsapple. President Trump gave a speech this summer touting the environmental achievements of his administration, but he left something out.
He is completely ignoring that carbon pollution and methane is still spiking in the U.S. and globally. Those are really alarming trends considering the time we have to fight climate change.
Can you talk about the environment without talking about climate change? Coming up, we'll look at what else was and wasn't in the president's speech. Stay tuned. The Philadelphia Energy Solutions oil refinery filed for bankruptcy. An explosion and fire tore through the facility in June and led the cash-strapped company to close. More than 1,000 people will lose their jobs. But some neighbors have cheered the end of the 150-year-old facility, the largest oil refinery on the East Coast. For State Impact Pennsylvania, Emily Pontecorvo reports on how the planned closure of the plant has sparked discussions on what a future without fossil fuel production could look like.
The closure of the largest oil refinery on the East Coast surprised everyone. It devastated refinery workers who, just days before, secured the facility and kept the city safe. Philadelphia Energy Solutions operator Brandon Peters says the refinery feels like home.
I love working at that refinery. I am heartbroken that it's over.
Peters' union, Steelworkers Local 101, wants a buyer to restart the facility. But residents living near the refinery complained for years about pollution that they say impacted their health. South Philadelphia resident Irene Russell is happy about the plant's closure.
I'm glad that happened. It needed to happen, and they ain't never got to open back up as far as I'm concerned, really.
Right now, the future of the 1,400-acre site is up in the air. And in a way, these very different views of what should happen next reflect a conversation that's taking place all over the country right now. How to transition away from fossil fuels, and at the same time, protect the good-paying jobs that fossil fuel production provides. Some advocates say that we can do both, and they call it a just transition. To be clear, the refinery did not shut down to cut carbon emissions, but a local environmental justice group called Philly Thrive sees the refinery's closure as a chance to talk about the so-called just transition. Organizer Alexa Ross is running an online petition to campaign for the idea.
We're currently, I just refreshed the page, we're at 298 signatures of Philadelphians who have said we want to just transition at the refinery.
Ross says the community should have a voice in determining the future of the refinery site. After all, at 1,400 acres, it's about the same size as Center City, Philadelphia. Her vision also includes training and financial support for workers. Refinery workers like Anna Maria Boyce want a job that pays well.
I'm sure whatever training that will be offered is not going to be equitable to what we have here. We're not going to make the same money.
Union refinery operators make between $70,000 and $120,000 a year. That's more than double what some jobs in renewable energy pay.
Transitioning away from a fossil fuel-based economy is going to involve pain. And who bears that pain, and when does it happen?
Patrick Young is a former organizer for the United Steelworkers in Pittsburgh. He actually worked on the campaign to save the South Philadelphia refinery when it almost closed back in 2011. Today, the steelworkers aren't talking about a just transition. They just want the refinery to stay open. But Young says the idea actually has roots in the labor movement.
A guy named Tony Mazzocchi, who was a leader, a really visionary leader in the oil, chemical, and atomic workers, really jumped onto the frame of a just transition.
Young says that in the 1990s, Mazzocchi realized the country would need to move away from fossil fuels because of climate change. He coined the term and the key ideas of a just transition.
Ideally, one of the principles of just transition is that people have time and early warning to realize the refinery that I'm working in is closing. It's closing in 4 years. And I can start making plans for what my life looks like in 5 years, 6 years, 7 years, and 8 years.
Obviously, that's not what happened in this case. 4 days after the explosion, workers read in a news report that they would lose their jobs. Young says that's why, if the refinery remains closed, Philadelphia Energy Solutions cannot be a good example of a just transition.
You know, that's just going to make everybody who works in the energy sector that much more terrified that, like, okay, well, if this is a just transition, what the hell is an unjust transition?
Still, some say our future depends on shutting down fossil fuel plants. South Philadelphia resident Shamar Pitts lives near the refinery, and he's not just concerned about air pollution. He's also worried about the increase in extreme hot weather and storms caused by climate change. Pitt says there is no win-win situation for his neighborhood and for the workers right now. But he's got a 6-week-old daughter, and he's worried about her future.
We care about the workers, but we have to change. There's no way we can go on like this. We won't survive.
The mayor's office has formed a working group to determine next steps for the refinery site. The group will hold its first public meeting later this month.
For State Impact Pennsylvania, Emily Pontecorvo.
Philadelphia wants public input on the future of the soon-to-be-shuttered refinery in South Philadelphia. The city has created a 26-member advisory group that draws from labor, academia, business, city government, and community groups. Three public meetings are scheduled, the first on August 6th. We're up to 66 episodes of our podcast, Trump on Earth, looking at changes in environmental policy under the Trump administration. Well, recently, we got to hear from the president himself directly about his track record on the environment. Surrounded by cabinet members, he gave a speech.
From day one, my administration has made it a top priority to ensure that America is among the very cleanest air and cleanest water on the planet.
But has the president and his administration made protecting the environment a top priority? The Allegheny Front's Reed Frazier invited Rebecca Lieber, a reporter with Mother Jones, to fact-check the president's speech.
He wrote that much of what Trump's speech was a lot like gaslighting. Let's listen to a segment of the speech that you wrote about.
One of the main messages of air pollution, particulate matter, is six times lower here than the global average. So we hear so much about some countries and what everyone is doing. We're six times lower than the average. That's a tremendous number. Since 2000, our nation's energy-related carbon emissions have declined more than any other country on Earth. Think of that. Emissions are projected to drop in 2019 and 2020. We're doing a very tough job, and not everybody knows it, and that's one of the reasons we're here today to speak to you.
Okay, so he goes on, but the message that he repeatedly is trying to get across is that, well, A, that this is a story that the media isn't telling, but B, that the United States is getting cleaner as its economy is growing. I mean, from your perspective covering the environment, what do you make of these statements? How true are they?
Well, Trump's doing a few things. One is he's just plain wrong to say that the U.S. has the cleanest air and cleanest water in the world. It can depend on the category, but on broad metrics for water and air, Switzerland actually usually gets that honor. But Trump's doing a couple other things at the same time. And one is changing the baseline. That's a really important factor in when we're looking at how much cleaner is the country now, is our air now than it was years ago. And if you're looking at the averages from the 60s and 70s when it was in its infancy, you get a lot dirtier rankings and dirtier metrics than you do when you consider a baseline that's more recent. So that's one thing that Trump has generally done in claiming all these successes is say, well, look at the U.S. a half century ago, we're doing much better off. And that, of course, has nothing to do with Trump. if anything, he's tried to take the EPA in the complete opposite direction. The other thing he's doing when he talks about clean air and water is he's ignoring climate pollution. Of course, this is a White House that doesn't like to talk about climate change, but he is completely ignoring that carbon pollution and methane is still spiking in the U.S. and globally. Those are really alarming trends considering the time we have to fight climate change. And just the last year, U.S. emissions went up again after a few years of that stalling or even declining a little bit.
Yeah, and to that point, you know, he brought up a number of cabinet members, David Bernhardt from the Department of Interior, several others whose purview touches on the environment, and he also brought up Andrew Wheeler.
Now I'd like to invite Administrator Andrew Wheeler up. He's at the EPA. He's doing a fantastic job. And he's keeping America clean, and we appreciate it very much. Andrew, please come up.
And I'm going to play a little bit from what Andrew Wheeler said.
From 1970 to 2018, U.S. criteria air pollution fell 74%, while the economy grew by 275%. Under your administration, emissions of all the criteria air pollutants continue to decline. For example, yes. For example, the lead and sulfur dioxide have dropped by double-digit percentages over the last 2 years. Today, we have the cleanest air on record, and we are a global leader for access to clean drinking water. We are making tremendous environmental progress under President Trump, and the public needs to know that.
So Wheeler is saying from 1970 to about now, we've seen tremendous drops in air pollution. How does that square with your understanding of what the Trump administration has done, knowing that it's tried to roll back you know, dozens and dozens of regulations, including many pertaining to air.
Yeah, just taking a few of the major ones, the fuel economy standards that the Trump administration is in the process of rolling back. Those are huge when we're considering the pollution that comes from our cars, and also the gains that would have been made through reducing carbon pollution. In addition to the fuel economy standards, they have looked at ozone standards, and basically ozone and smog has gotten better in the last few decades, but it still means unhealthy air for tens of millions of Americans. And the science over the last few years shows that actually the levels that the EPA has previously considered safe, or at least their standard, are still far too high. They're still unhealthy and triggering for sensitive populations. And the Trump administration has undermined those standards. They've also pulled back on environmental enforcement, which is another huge piece beyond the deregulation that they've undertaken, by dropping civil penalties 85% last year.
But it seems to me like saying that air quality has improved since 1970 just means that the Clean Air Act has done a really good job of cleaning up the air. So it seems odd to, you know, tout your own environmental policies when you didn't really do those policies. Those are policies of past governments.
Yeah, he's taking credit for a lot of work that he's not responsible for. I think the other thing he's doing when he says, look how great the environment is doing, he's trying to build a case for no more regulation, saying, well, we did our job, we're done, now let's just worry about the economy. And one thing he kept repeating in his speech is that it's not about the economy versus the environment, which is interesting. It was kind of a twist on what I've heard a lot of Democrats and environmentalists also argue, that it isn't about the economy versus the environment, because what environmentalists argue is the environment, a good environment, helps the economy. But what Trump was saying was a good economy helps the environment. He was flipping that, and he was saying, well, economic growth means environmental gains and technological gain. And as the Clean Air Act showed us, economic gain does not translate to less pollution. In fact, it can translate to lots more pollution. So the Clean Air Act shows us how the government plays an important role here in making sure when the economy grows that it's clean.
Rebecca Lieber is a reporter with Mother Jones. She joined the Allegheny Front's Reed Frazier on the Trump on Earth podcast. There's more of their conversation at TrumpOnEarth.org or wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for joining us on the Allegheny Front. You can always find us on Facebook and Twitter at Allegheny Front. Kathy Naur is the executive producer of our show. I'm Carol Holsapple.
Support for the Allegheny Front comes from the Heinz Endowments, the Pittsburgh Foundation, and the Park Foundation. The Richard King Mellon Foundation supports our coverage of conservation. The Sears Sweatland Family Foundation supports our coverage in Ohio. And the Robert F. Schumann Foundation supports our podcast, Trump on Earth. State Impact Pennsylvania is a collaboration among the Allegheny Front, WESA, WITF, and WHYY to cover the Commonwealth's energy economy.